So hi, welcome everyone. You are on the online class, Caring for Your Child's Health. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Heather Arruda. I'm a co-founder of Mommy Bites. I'm very, very excited for this teleclass today. This is an important teleclass. It's unusual to get basically one-on-one time with a doctor to get all your questions answered, and that's basically what we've created here. We have some common questions that we'll go through, but again, we welcome any specific questions you have. Now's the time to ask them. Ask as many questions as you want. Type them in, jump in on the phones, whatever works for you. A little bit about our sponsor that has made this teleclass possible. It's a really cool new company called Pager. So the next time your child is sick, you could skip the long waits and germ exposure of urgent care and use Pager to request a doctor to see you at your home right away. So Pager is a mobile app based in New York that offers on-demand doctor visits to your home or office. Pager's board-certified and experienced doctors can treat children, infants, and older, as well as adults and the elderly. Pager treats many urgent care issues, including cold and flu, stomach problems, cuts and sprains, and much more, in all less than 2 hours. I'm going to send you a link, but you can download the Pager app to request a doctor with just a tap of the button. I'll also send you their website. So big thank you to Pager. I also want to welcome our doctor on today's teleclass, Dr. Henderson. Welcome, Dr. Henderson.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm great. I'm great. So we have a lot to get through. Before we get into the nitty-gritty, can you just tell people a little bit about your background, Dr. Henderson, and your role at Pager?
Absolutely. So I am a board-certified residency-trained emergency physician. So that basically means I see all kinds of patients, adults and children, in the emergency department. I deal with, you know, life-threatening injuries, common colds, musculoskeletal complaints, anything that comes in. I'm also a physician for Pager, and we go to patients' homes, to their places of business. If they're out of town visiting in their hotel room, we meet them wherever they are and take care of what they need.
Awesome. It's such a great business model. I don't know if people heard me before, but it's a really, really great business model. So we're happy to have you. Let's get right to it, Dr. Henderson. So summer's over. We're kind of getting into fall. Can you talk a little bit about what you think are the most common infections or illnesses for children in this season?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind, you know, as the weather's obviously getting a little cooler is, believe it or not, even though we're still very close to the summer season, it's time to start worrying about flu, especially if you have maybe one child that's a little bit older in their school age and then you have an infant at home. You know, flu is extremely contagious. So, and it's usually, it presents very classically. It's fever, it's watery eyes, it's body aches and pains, it's the, you know, harsh cough. So influenza is the big one that everybody's thinking about right now. I'm sure all of your doctors are encouraging me to get your flu shots. The other sort of more pediatric-based maladies as the kids go back to school, and they're exposed to their friends and all the germs and everything else. You know, you see the little ones with something called hand, foot, mouth disease. It's caused by Coxsackie. It's a viral infection. They end up with painful sores in their mouth. If they're very, very young, you know, if they're still being bottle fed or nursed, sometimes it will prevent them from eating or drinking appropriately because of the pain in their mouth. That's also contagious, so it can go through an entire school, or a family with the same type of viral syndrome. And then the bigger ones, the scarier ones that you'll see in this young pediatric age group is croup. Croup is characteristically starts with a very harsh barking. People will call it a seal-like cough. I haven't heard many seals bark, but that's what it's supposed to sound like. The child is usually, you know, febrile and very uncomfortable looking. And it can be a very dramatic presentation. You know, it comes on very quickly. The fever can be quite high, and the cough is significant. So those are characteristic infections of the colder weather.
And Dr. Henderson, we actually already have questions coming in. Listeners, again, if you have further questions to the ones that are coming in, please type in or chime in on the phone by pressing *7. But one of the questions we have is circling back to the flu shot. This mom wants to know, does my child need the flu shot every year? And she says, I've heard that the flu shot can often cause the flu. Is this true?
So that's a great question. I'm glad you brought it up. The flu shot is required every year because the way they're formulated now, they are meant to predict what the most common strains of influenza will be for that calendar year. So based upon, the flu sort of changes from year to year. The different strains they mutate, they travel. You know, they look at where flu was, during the year before, and they try to anticipate, they being the CDC, you know, what the next strain of flu will be. So having, even if you had the same flu shot, you know, if you received the same flu shot this year that they were giving out last year, that wouldn't necessarily cover the strains of flu for this year. So that it's very important to get an appropriate flu shot for each year. Now, word on the street has it that the CDC is getting close to coming up with a multi-year flu shot, but it just is not available to date. But that's coming, so look ahead for that. To answer the second part of your question in terms of the flu shot giving the flu, it's just not true. The flu shot is denatured, so it's not a live virus. It's not like what you would see in the MMR virus, which is actually a live virus. So the flu shot is denatured. Now, it might make you a little achy. You know, some people, even adults, will get a febrile response, but it is, you know, a hundredth of the effect of what you would get with full-blown influenza virus. So sometimes what will happen, and you've probably been through it before, when you're in your pediatrician's office and it's time for shots and your child gets varicella or MMR or, you know, whatever immunizations are appropriate, after the visit, he or she may be a little achy or cranky, and the pediatricians usually, you know, very routinely recommend giving, you know, one dose of Tylenol or ibuprofen just to quell the symptoms, but it is not the flu shot does not cause the full blown influenza infection. No, it doesn't.
And Dr. Henderson, more and more now, depending on the age of the child, we say flu shot, but it also can be a nasal spray, right? It doesn't have to be a
shot. Oh, sure,
shot,
the flu. Yes. That's right.
And
it
it's just
be
as effective.
Influenza. Yes, and you know, it's funny. Some children and adults, I'm sure, but some children really don't like anything up their nose. I've seen children very upset with the flu mist as well. So I don't know that it's quite the panacea that everyone thinks it is. Obviously, there's no needle, but it is a full injection or spray up the nose. So it depends on what your kids are sensitive to.
It's so funny you say that. I actually, my older son chose, his doctor gave him a choice whether he wanted the nasal spray or the shot, and he actually chose the shot. It's so interesting. Yeah, some kids, that the sensation of anything up their nose is worse than the shot. So it's
exactly
nice to have options now.
No, it's true. We do have options. So if it, you know, for an older child, I would definitely let him or her choose, but just, you know, the sensation up the nose can be it can be disturbing.
Totally. So we have another question that's come in. Let me just read. So she's asking, when you were talking about hand, foot, and mouth, and the seal, she's saying, oh, the croup. When should a parent bring them to the doctor?
So that's a really, really great question as well. And we're talking about croup here?
She's saying when you were saying the seal, like when they have the seal called.
Oh, the seal. So we're talking about croup, right? Laryngeal tracheitis, you know, better known as croup. So the croup will typically present with that barky cough with a very, very high fever. Your pediatricians will definitely tell you, and it's the right thing to say, you want to be aggressive in terms of treating the fever, you know, Tylenol, appropriate weight-based Tylenol and Motrin. You know, you can bring them into a steamy shower because it will help them, help the symptoms. But if you ever feel like your child is having difficulty breathing, that's number one. And number two, there's a phenomenon where croup is typically viral. You know, most croup, it begins as a viral infection. If the child gets dramatically worse, say that they've been sick for 1 or 2 days, maybe they're partially sick, but they get better with Tylenol or Motrin. If their symptoms get dramatically worse in a day or in a couple of hours and the fever shoots up super high, 103, 104, the breathing gets more labored and stridorous, you know, that you hear funny sounds when they breathe, then I would actually say, you know, I'd probably forego the trip to the pediatrician's office and go right to the emergency department, because especially in young children where the airway is small, you just want to make sure that they're not having any severe difficulty breathing. So if you have any concerns about your child having difficulty breathing that's getting worse with the croup, I would take him or her to the closest available emergency department so the emergency physician can just make sure there's no problem with the airway.
And Dr. Henderson, my follow-up question to that, and we get this at Mommy Bites, and I remember when my boys were young, this is my always like most common question. With fever, at what point does a parent bring them in to see the doctor? Like, I know there's probably a range, and it depends on the age of the child, but is there kind of a go-to number?
Yeah, I mean, anything that's much above, you know, 101.8, 102, that's been going on for more than a couple of days is a concern. Now, parents will recognize the fever, give the Tylenol or Motrin, and the fever will go down. But if you keep having to give the Tylenol or Motrin for more than 2 or 3 or 4 days, it's too long. And obviously, if you have a temperature that's extremely high, you know, 103, 104, you want to have that addressed right away, because especially in the younger child, you know, the infants up to 2 or 3 years old, you can end up with a phenomenon called a febrile seizure, which means that the child will actually have, and this is not an epileptic child or anything like that, it's a perfectly normal child, but depending upon how fast that fever shoots up, you know, it goes from 98.7 to 104, you know, in an hour, the kid may actually have a seizure. So those are, and obviously if your child has a febrile seizure, please bring them to the emergency department. But if the fever persists more than, especially if you're getting to the fifth day and they still have fever, you're going to need to have that checked out, because there are certain other infections that you begin to worry about after the fifth day of fever.
Got it. Okay. These are great questions, by the way. These are for both. These are awesome questions, guys. If, again, feel free to type them in. There's a landing page. You are sent a link, and you are welcome to type in questions. For those of you that have joined us on the phone, you're welcome to chime in anytime by pressing *7 on your phone. That's how you unmute yourself. And we'll just keep the questions going. My follow-up question to when to take a child in if they have a fever is, I think, another common question, and that is, when should parents be concerned about a bump or a bruise or sprain? I feel like a lot of parents, you know, child falls off the bed, hits their head, you know, do you bring them in? What do you do?
So that is a very common visit to the emergency department. I'm happy to report that most kids that, you know, fall off the bed or bump their head do perfectly fine. The way it usually happens is the mom or dad will bring in their child, and the child is either crying or, you know, they're okay at that point, but they rolled off the bed or maybe it's an unwitnessed fall. The first thing that I ask all of those parents, just to make sure I'm not dealing with anything more serious, is what happened after the kid fall. If they fell or hit their head and they cried right away, chances are it's going to be completely fine. And I know that sounds strange. You know, why do you want to know that my kid was crying and in pain? But that's the normal reaction, right? If you fall and you hit your head and it hurts, you should cry. I'm much more worried about the kids that fall and hit their head and they don't cry, or the ones that are in the emergency department and I'm looking in their ears and their nose and, you know, turning them all around and they don't cry. They should cry. They should have stranger anxiety. They're in a strange place. They're uncomfortable. They should definitely cry. That's the right reaction. So if you see an injury and the kid falls and they're dazed, or, you know, they don't cry, or they lay there, or if they're vomiting, or if they're complaining of pain in their head, I would absolutely go right to the emergency department and not wait. If they cry, you know, if they hit their head and they start screaming and then they're fine and they're acting normally and you're somewhere where you can observe the child for 3 or 4 hours, that should be just fine too. But if they don't cry, there's visual complaints, they won't walk, they're throwing up, any of those are red flags that I would recommend bringing to the emergency department.
And I would also add, you know, I have told, when my sons were little, I told my caregiver this as well. If they fall, you know, just to, that's the question that you just asked, like what happened next, I always would ask my caregiver too. So I just share that with our listeners. If you weren't there, then, you know, a good idea to do what Dr. Henderson just suggested is, you know, what happened? Were they dizzy? Did they eat? All those questions. Because sometimes it's hard if you didn't see it. You're not quite sure how severe it was.
Right, exactly. So that's the perfect question to ask. You know, one, did they cry? Two, what happened afterwards? And, you know, no one's going to know your kid better than you know your kid. And you know what's normal for your child. You know, if they usually, when they're feeling well, they like to, you know, play with the ball, or they like to hide under the bed, or whatever is their normal routine, and they're doing their normal routine even though they hit their head and now they seem fine, that's a good sign. If they're not doing their normal routine, or they're more irritable than usual, or for little kids they won't feed, or they're fussy, then it's worth a trip to, you know, to either your local provider or your closest available emergency department, just to make sure everything is okay.
Got it. Okay. Next question that's come in is, how about with sprains? So we just went over head injury, but how does a parent know when to bring a child in with a sprain or fracture or broken bone?
So a lot of the information is the same. After you see them fall off the bike or, you know, fall out of the swing and they're complaining of pain in a limb or a wrist or whatever, the question is, you know, what happened after the fall? Is the child able to move the extremity, or they can't or won't move it because of severe pain? Is there any obvious deformity or angulation? And what was the mechanism of injury? Was it just, you know, a fall from, you know, 1 foot or something very slight, or were they hanging on the monkey bars and fell, you know, right onto their elbow? All of those different variables will play into, well, you know, it's probably going to be okay. She's moving her arm. She's running around. She's acting normally. Or, wow, she won't really bear weight. She's, you know, screaming in pain whenever I touch it. You know, I should probably have it taken, you know, at least have a look at. The good news is, you know, most kids are much more flexible than we are. Things that would cause, you know, an absolute broken bone in an adult, many times don't cause that same degree of injury in a child. Depending on the age of the child, that the bones are still very soft, so they tend to bend, literally bend before they break. Kids, especially with long bone injuries, have something called green stick fractures, meaning that, you know, like a green part of a tree or a limb, you can bend it and it'll bend. And it might even crack a little bit on one side, but it's not a true fracture. It doesn't go through and through. But that doesn't mean that it shouldn't be looked at. The question is, do you have to go in at 3 o'clock in the morning to the emergency department, or can you follow up you know, the next day with your pediatrician. So that's number one. Number two, for little ones, you know, those that are, you know, less than 5 years old, you know, more in the 2 to 3 year old range, there's this phenomenon called a nursemaid's elbow. And it's very interesting because the child is very upset and obviously in pain and screams and cries and acts all the world like a fracture, but it's not a fracture. Usually the mechanism of injury is something that I know I've done to my own kids, and I'm sure it's not uncommon. You know, maybe you're trying to get across the street or trying to do something quickly, or maybe you're just, you know, walking down the street and you're swinging the kid just having fun. Well, remember, all the connections and the ligaments and everything in the pediatric patient are lax because they're supposed to be. So if you do pull on a small child's arm, you know, you pull it forward, you can have those ligaments sort of release. They let go of the area around the elbow, and the child will not use that arm. They won't move the hand. They won't move the arm. If you try to move the arm, they'll scream in pain. But it's not a fracture. It's just a simple dislocation. And pretty much any pediatrician, I know any, you know, emergency physician will very gently reduce that nursemaid's elbow without, you know, having to go through x-rays or sedation or casting or anything like that. And it just puts the joint and ligaments, the little soft ligaments, back in place. But a nursemaid's elbow is scary, and the child will be very upset. So that's something to look for. And just remember, you know, be careful when you're swinging, you know, a little kid's arm.
And in keeping with the theme about, you know, asking the child what happened or how they feel, I remember when my kids were toddlers, it's sometimes hard to figure out after they fall if they're crying because they're hurt or they're kind of embarrassed or, you know, something else happened. So I remember my friend, and I copied it from her, I used to say, you know, what hurts? Is it your body or your pride? Because sometimes it's their pride, you know?
Yeah, I know that would work with adults, so.
Yeah. So, Dr. Henderson, can we talk a little bit about ear infections? It seems to me those happen more often in children, and is there any way that parents can prevent them?
So ear infections are definitely a disease of the young child, and it's usually a physiologic developmental thing that they'll grow out of. So the eustachian tubes, the ear tubes, are much more horizontal in the young child, allowing for fluid to build up behind the ear. As they get older and the eustachian tubes go, you know, move into their adult dimension, they become less horizontal and they slope downward to allow for normal drainage, so you don't get as much buildup of that fluid behind the ear. So, you know, the ear infection, the acute otitis media, has been, the bane of the pediatrician's existence since the beginning of man, because it's a hard spot to be in. You know that most of these diseases, most otitis medias, are viral because, you know, most infections are viral. That's just true. But there are a subset of the otitis medias that are bacterial, which would, you know, benefit from antibiotics. It is not very easy in a young screaming patient who's obviously in pain to tell the two apart. Viral otitis media will present with fever and pain, can present with drainage, just like its bacterial counterpart. So what the American Association of Pediatrics has gone on to recommend, that in a normal child with no comorbidities that's older than two, it's safe to take sort of a wait-and-see approach to antibiotics. The way it usually is handled with the pediatricians, they will examine the child, you know, find the big bulging tympanic membrane, the pain, the fever, and based upon their symptoms, still obviously treat the child for any pain or fever with Tylenol or Motrin, and give the parent a prescription for amoxicillin, or if they're penicillin allergic, usually the drug of choice is azithromycin, and tell the parents to wait and see, which basically means, you know, watch your son or daughter over the next 12 to 24 hours. If all their symptoms resolve with just the dose of Tylenol and Motrin, and they don't have any more fever and the pain goes away and everything resolves and they're fine in 24 hours, then you don't need to start the antibiotics. It's more than likely viral and will be fine. And if the symptoms worsen or they don't resolve with just the Tylenol and Motrin, you know, go ahead and start the antibiotics. Because, you know, all the pediatricians know that antibiotics are not to be given lightly, and antibiotics have a lot of bad side effects of their own. Kids get really, really bad diarrhea with antibiotics. If it's the first time maybe they've had an amoxicillin or penicillin-based product, they can have an allergic reaction. And even if they're not allergic to penicillin, they can develop a drug rash. So it's not a medication to be given lightly. And even though people think that penicillin is the worst offender, you know, kids get raucous diarrhea also with azithromycin or the Z-Pak. So, you know, in terms of ear infections, they are real and they should all be treated, but they should not necessarily all be treated with antibiotics.
It's a good point. I think, you know, we went through a phase in this country where it was like the fallback, like, oh, what's, even if they don't need it, what's the downside? Just give it to them to be better safe than sorry. And more I've noticed with my own doctors, really asking parents to kind of treat the pain with Tylenol and Motrin and the wait and see, and not have it be the fallback. So I think you bring up an interesting and important point. We have a question that's just been typed in, so I'm going to read it to you directly so I get it right. And before I do that, just quickly, I want to again thank Pager, our sponsor of today's teleclass, for making today possible. Teleclass and Pager is actually a mobile app, so the next time your child is sick, you can skip the long waits and germ exposure of urgent care and use Pager to request a doctor at your home right away. Dr. Henderson, who's on with us right now, is actually a doctor at Pager. So I will send you the link to that app. So I want to read you this question, Dr. Henderson. So this caller says, I gave my 9-week-old gripe water for the first time last night because he's been grunting the night and not sleeping. He immediately fell asleep, completely out. And it kind of worried us as well. What are your feelings about gripe water? Have you heard of this happening? Is it safe? That's a great question.
Now, that is an excellent question. I've heard of the anecdotal stories with gripe water. You know, it can be soothing. It can help a kid that might be a little bit colicky or fussy. I don't know that you'll find any double-blind controlled studies on grape water. I think it's more of just the soothing effect. It should have no long-term adverse effect on the kid. It can make them a little groggy or sleepy, almost like if you gave them, you know, a teaspoon or a half a teaspoon, depending upon their weight, of Benadryl, kind of the same idea. But they usually, when they wake up, they walk it off and it's just gone. It doesn't have any long-lasting effects that I have ever heard of.
Okay. It's a great question, though.
That is a great question.
And listeners, please feel free to keep the questions coming, either chime in on your phone or type them in our remaining few minutes. I want to make sure I get to everything. Dr. Henderson, can we talk a little bit about, I feel like this is another common one, just looking back when my boys were younger, how parents can deal with diarrhea and or constipation.
Right. Oh, gosh, the GI maladies.
Brings it right back, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, fortunately, most diarrhea, I feel like I'm sounding like a broken record, but fortunately, most diarrhea in the pediatric population is viral and self-limited. It really all depends on the history. You know, if you just returned from, I don't know, a trip to Mexico, or you were, you know, in sub-Saharan Africa on a safari, you know, then all bets are off and you might need a little bit more investigation. But simple diarrhea, for the most part, is viral, and you can treat it supportively. The biggest danger in the pediatric population is hydration, right? It's not hard for a young child, and the younger the child, the easier it is for her to become dehydrated. So the biggest thing that you're going to be chasing in a kid with just fulminant, you know, ongoing diaper fill-in diarrhea is hydration. So a few things. One, you know, stay away from the milk as much as possible, because believe it or not, the milk can exacerbate diarrhea. Usually you're just going to want to orally rehydrate them with simple liquids that have electrolytes in them. Pedialyte is a good one, it's, you know, not because of the brand, but just because it has the electrolytes, anything to keep them hydrated. Now, if you notice that your kid has been having diarrhea for several days and, you know, they're not making as many wet diapers, or they cry and they don't have tears, or if it's a small baby and the fontanelle, the soft spot on the top of the head looks sunken, or their eyes look sunken and they are really clinically dehydrated, then, you know, cut bait and go to your closest available emergency department so they can assess the child for dehydration and need of, you know, IV fluid replacement. But if it's a typical school age kid and it's diarrhea and it's just for a couple of days, usually if you just treat them conservatively, if you replace the fluids, if you, you know, give them things that are not milk-based to eat, you know, you can give them rice or bread to slow down the diarrhea, it will usually go away. Things to look for in diarrhea: you want to make sure that the diarrhea is not black or bloody. You want to make sure that the diarrhea is not explosive or high-volume diarrhea, especially if you have been traveling, because there are bacterial infections that will cause that kind of diarrhea. You know, E. coli will do that, and, you know, different Giardia and things like that. So if it is ongoing for more than 2 or 3 days, if it's very, very high volume or very, very foul-smelling, or if it's black or bloody, or if the child is showing stigmata or signs and symptoms of dehydration, then I would definitely take them in to be evaluated. On the flip side, constipation is usually functional in the pediatric population. It's usually a matter of what they eat. Sometimes people can have, you know, parents can have very picky eaters. I had one very cute little girl come into the emergency department with constipation, and she only eats food that's yellow. So her diet pretty much just consisted of macaroni and cheese, or, you know, different cheese or bread or cream, you know, and she didn't have regular bowel movements, which is what you would expect. So if you take the moment and really sit down and think about, you know, what does my child eat? Are they drinking enough water? That's another really big culprit. Sometimes it can be hard to get little ones to drink water. Now, if you go all the way back to the newborn period, or the, you know, the very small child, the 1 month old, the 2 month old, it is not out of the ordinary for them to go 1 or 2 or however many days without moving their bowels. You'll see that more so in kids that are bottle fed formula as opposed to the kids that are nursed, because the nursed babies usually have bowel movements all over the place. That I remember clearly. And they're these little mustard seedy small bowel movements, that it's just the nurse kids tend to have more regular bowel movements than the bottle fed formula kids. So that's something to know. It is not unusual for them to go several days without moving their bowels. But if you notice your newborn is in distress when they're trying to move their bowels, if, you know, they're in a lot of pain, if you look down and there's blood in the diaper, you know, anything like that is worth at least, a call or a trip to your regular pediatrician, or if it's after hours or on the weekend, you know, make your way to the emergency department. Just there are some very, very rare, that usually never happen, but are some diseases in that age, that newborn age period, or that young child that you would not want to miss, you know, or Hirschsprung's or something like that. They're, again, very rare, but you wouldn't want to miss it.
Got it. So, listeners, we have time for one or two more questions. If you have any more questions, please type them in or chime in. I have one here that I want to get to. This is a good one. What is Dr. Henderson's opinion on giving children vitamins?
It's interesting. I remember that vitamins tend to cycle. They're either completely in favor or completely out of favor. I think, and it's a weaselly answer, it depends. For most children that are healthy, they don't have any, you know, chronic medical conditions. You know, it's not a kid with cerebral palsy, or it's not a TET kid, or it's not, you know, perfect healthy infant that, you know, is feeding well, either nursing well, or has a normal diet, or normal, you know, normal varied diet. It's usually not helpful, but it's usually not harmful. And so if you're just talking about like the one a day, the little vitamins they take, or the drops that you can give the pediatric patients, it's usually not helpful or harmful if they have a varied diet and they don't have any medical problems. For the very premature infants, for the infants that do suffer with cystic fibrosis, with, you know, different chronic medical diseases, or if you've got a picky guy, you know, maybe my younger son, when he was little, just didn't like milk. Just, I could not sneak it in any way, shape, or form. So if you know you've got one of those characters on your hands, it's not a bad idea. I never liked the idea of giving superhuman doses of anything. You know, I know there are some proponents of the, you know, the 10,000 unit dose of vitamin C and this and that. The good news is most vitamins are water soluble. So the only thing that happens when you take those super therapeutic doses is you end up losing most of them when you use the bathroom. But there are some vitamins, those are the fat-soluble vitamins A, D, E, and K. You want to be really careful about giving, you know, superhuman doses of those to little people because you can, there are problems with huge doses of A, D, E, and K, or any of the fat-soluble vitamins. But, as you know, as a rule, if your kid is healthy and happy and they're feeding well, they're nursing well, and they don't have any stigmata of any chronic diseases, it probably won't help, but it probably won't hurt.
And maybe, you know, keep your pediatricians in the loop depending on the age
Absolutely.
Of your child and what vitamins they're taking. Yeah.
Absolutely.
We have time for one last question that's been typed in. This actually, again, my children are older, so I think this is probably new, and I'm curious if you've heard of it. So this caller says, we've used the Windy, it's spelled W-I-N-D-I, by Frida Baby, to relieve our baby's gas. I heard that might hinder the baby to be able to pass gas on his or her own. The Windy did not work, and it also pushed the stool through. After hearing that, I'm hesitant to use it. Do you know about the Windy baby?
I mean, what very little I know about it. This came after my kids. It's more along the lines of almost like an adult GasX. So it's not cathartic. It's not the kind of thing that will help push stool through. It just relieves the pain of the pressure of the gas. What little exposure I've had to it, it doesn't have any long-term or effects or deleterious sequelae. It's the reason why the child has buildup of gas is that they're miserably constipated. It will probably help marginally with the gas, but it's not going to do a whole lot with the constipation. But be wary of giving little kids or babies especially a lot of laxatives or cathartics or things like that, because it's very easy to overshoot. And then instead of having a child with constipation, you have a child with this, you know, chemically induced raucous diarrhea, and then you end up with the problem of dehydration and all of that. So if you really have a kid that's having just, you know, horrible GI symptoms and you can't pin down, you know, what the food is that's upsetting him, or, you know, what the, maybe they're not drinking enough water, whatever, and it's chronic, it, again, it's worth one trip to your pediatrician or even, you know, a pediatric gastroenterologist, because especially in smaller kids, you know, in newborns, they can suffer with silent syndromes like reflux disease that will make them miserably uncomfortable, or maybe they're allergic to one of the components in their formula. You know, they may need a soy-based formula as opposed to the milk-based formula. They may need a gentle formula. They may, you know, it depends. And if they're premature, you know, all bets are off. So I wouldn't expect any type of long-term sequelae from Malindi, but if it's a chronic problem, I would bring it to your pediatrician's attention.
That's a great, great question. Thank you, listeners. These were awesome, awesome questions, so thank you. I want to thank Dr. Henderson. You're just awesome to work with, so thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Yeah, and Dr. Henderson and I were just saying before, we both have kind of boys, we have teenagers, so we're at the same stage. So it was really nice connecting with you, so thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm looking forward to it. Enjoy the fall with your children and your babies. It's a lot of fun. Have fun for Halloween and Christmas, and stay healthy, and I wish you all well.
Thank you so much. Big thank you to Pager. I will send you the link to their app, everyone. And best of luck on your parenting journeys, and happy fall, everyone.